Welcome everyone to the first episode of Misspent Matinee with Blaine and Chris. How's it going, Chris?
Hey, Blaine. It's going great. How you doing?
Oh, man, doing good. Just enjoying this long, rainy week, but ready to get back talking about movies. As you guys know, I'm Blaine, and you might know me from my other podcast, Grindhouse Messiah, here on the Farsighted Network. I also write at thefarsightedblog.com and my site, mondomclaren.com. I'm mostly known for being a B-movie and cult shit movie type, but wanted to do a show covering more mainstream titles. My first thought was to call up my good friend and ex-wife's new husband, Chris. He's a guy with good taste in film and a person that I'm proud to co-parent with. He's a writer, lawyer, and all-around good dude. Chris, I'm going to hand it over to you and let the listeners get to know you a bit.
Thanks, Blaine. Yeah, so we ended up getting to know each other kind of in a weird, more modern way. Our connection is your ex-wife, my current wife, Robin, who is also producing this podcast. And
Dr. Robin.
And yes, it's Dr. Robin. Everyone who's around her will know that. And so we got together because of that, but we ended up getting close because of our boys, Blaine and Robin's boy, Mac, who's 7, and mine and Robin's boy, Soren, who's 3.5. And we just kind of started talking about that in movies. And so we ended up getting this idea. We're going to do a podcast together talking about all the different movies that had an impact in our lives, and also a little bit about current movies and current media that we are watching. And Blaine, yeah, I'll let you take it over from here.
Okay, excellent. And because you already mentioned her, I also want to introduce our producer, the mother of both of our children, Dr. Robin Sargent. Hey, when you aren't conquering the world of online learning, what else are you doing?
Well, I'm making more children.
That's right. True. As we speak.
Yes, I'm currently growing legs that are due in October.
I hope they're longer than my legs.
Yeah. I'm a director of a training department at a recruiting and staffing firm. I work from home full time and just, I work at home, but I try to, live like a stay-at-home mom.
No, that's awesome. And you're also a Leo, and
I'm just kidding. Oh, Sagittarius.
I don't know anything about that.
My moon sign is either. Gemini.
I have no idea about that. She's also
Blaine is an Aries, and Chris is a Gemini.
She has bullied our doctor into scheduling the birth according to numerology.
10/9/17.
Like
Gemini moon.
Like any logical person would.
Obviously.
She's not a doctor of science, but
no, it's a lot of education.
Yeah, that's right. With an undergrad in religion.
Yeah, well, excellent. Well, on this first episode, what we mainly wanted to do was just get an opportunity to let you guys know a little bit about us, our background, and also our general taste in movies. So on this first episode, we're going to be getting into our overall top tens, as well as some duly noted films that may have barely missed the list, but still want to be able to talk and kind of about how it shapes our overall taste. Our future episodes are going to be a little bit different in the way that we structure them. We're going to be mainly focusing in on one major film and then doing offshoot top five lists according to it. So any films that you, the listener, have in mind or any ideas for lists, please always feel free to reach out to us, let us know, and we're always going to take those into consideration. So tonight we're going to just kind of hop right into it and start off with Chris's number 10 film and let him introduce that and kind of talk about what it means to him and kind of how it shapes his overall taste.
Yeah, that's right. And this was much more difficult than I imagined, trying to limit the favorite films, the films that have had the biggest impact on my life, to just 10. This is It's still a work in progress, to tell you the truth. If someone comes up and tells me a different movie, it might replace one of the movies we're going to talk about today, because I've already gone through maybe 8 or 9 iterations of my top 10 list. It's thinking that it's complete and then suddenly finding out that it needed to be revised. So my first movie that I want to talk about is, it's not my number 10 movie. It's my number one movie. It's Jaws. And I know that this is probably not surprising to any of our listeners. I think a lot of people think that Jaws is one of the best movies of all time. But it's also one of the movies that has just completely shaped the way that I even watch film. And Jaws was one of the movies that I was able to watch at a very early age, probably too early. And I do really believe that it has completely changed the way that I look at films in general. One of the things, and Blaine, Jaws did not make your top 10.
It didn't, but not because it's a film that doesn't deserve to be there, or that's a film that's not one of my favorite movies of all time. Mainly because I steered a little bit away from a few directors in particular. The three big being Kubrick, Spielberg, and Alfred Hitchcock, because I could have just packed the top 10 list with most of their films. I could have probably done a top 20 of those three. But I have a similar relationship with the film as well, where I saw it when I was young. It was kind of one of those first, you know, at that time, kind of scary movies that I ever saw. And it really kind of whetted my appetite for that more B-level movie, because as much as it is top quality cinema, it's still a very B-movie story. And I go back to it every year, right around Memorial Day. I always end up popping it in and kicking back and enjoying it, and then end up watching 2, 3, and 4, and getting a little depressed with Mario Van Peebles in the end. But
there's no one more depressed about Mario Van Peebles than Mario Van Peebles Sr. One of the things that I'm glad you brought that up.
You mean Melvin Van Peebles.
Oh, Melvin Van. That's there you go. Yeah, that's sweet. Right. I always consider him senior.
I'm glad
you brought that up. Looking at my list, I am just almost like just grotesquely mainstream. I might as well have been about as white bread and I don't know, blah, 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 blah. So one of the things I realized about looking at my list is just how mainstream it was, and then looking at your list, how off the beaten path it was. And it really did make me think that I probably should expand my horizons a little bit, even though, there are some things that when I started making this list, I started thinking about movies that I had seen, that I wanted to take with me if I had to go to a desert island and only have 10 movies that I could watch for the rest of my life. And a lot of that ended up being movies that I had seen a lot, movies that are eminently rewatchable, movies that I could just put in on no matter what's going on in my life and sit back and watch the entire thing. So Jaws was one of those movies. And it really was the very first movie that came into my mind. And throughout the entire process of thinking about the movies and which movies I wanted to put on the list, it never shook its top spot.
Right.
And, it was, it's like Jaws. We'll go through the rest, but Jaws was the clear number one for me.
No. And it's well deserving of that spot. Since you hopped right into number one, I'll do mine as well. And my top film, I think, is very different, but also a little similar in the way that it handles a genre. My number one film is the Dario Argento Suspiria, which has been a movie originally released in 1977, kind of a supernatural Italian giallo film. that really kind of embodies what I love most about films. It kind of disregards story and just takes kind of a kitchen sink approach where it's constantly just chucking everything at the film and everything at the viewer and allowing you to just kind of sit back, enjoy the excitement. You almost lose yourself in trying to follow what is a pretty loose storyline overall. Basically, it's following a young lady who's just gone off to a kind of fancy ballet academy and gradually starts to realize that the school is a front for something a little bit more sinister than she initially thought. And as you go through it, it's rich in color, cinematography. It's incredibly gory and visceral, but ends up kind of culminating into something that I just think is special. And when I'm sitting around on a rainy Sunday afternoon and I've got nothing else better to do, it seems to be that film that I just kind of toss in, and no matter what I'm doing, I stop, I end up sitting on the couch and watching it from beginning to end. So, I mean, and what I meant with relating a little bit to a film like Jaws is, Jaws took this, kind of nature run amok sort of monster movie and transformed it into a blockbuster film. Suspiria takes that giallo genre that was popular in the 70s into the early 80s in Italy and twists it into a more supernatural tale, more of a fairy tale, while still holding on to things like the black glove killer, the bright red paint style blood, and ends up like Jaws, becoming something I think very special, and that a reason why you continue to see reissues of the film and it continues to be part of the popular lexicon. So what was the next film that you'd want to that you'd like to talk about, Chris?
Well, before we even get into that, one of the things that I find very interesting about your films is, and I'm glad that we're talking about it, is whether or not you are focused on experimental, groundbreaking films, which in my experience are rewarding but not necessarily rewatchable, or whether or not you were focused on movies that are. And it sounds like this first film is one of those that you will, if you have some time, you have some free time, you're going to sit down, you're going to put this movie in.
Right. And I mean, if you follow any of my other writings or shows, you'll learn real fast. I don't give a shit about story. It's really the furthest thing. Plot. those are the things that I'm least concerned about. For me, with film, a lot of it is the level of entertainment that it involves me in, the overall fun, and I kind of approach it from that side very much, from my taste. So, as I go through this list, you'll see, because there's also some real goofy shit on here as well. So, I mean, so when I'm taking in these favorite films, I'm not really, for me, a serious picture is great, and I enjoy it. I enjoy a mature film experience, every now and then, but my leanings throughout life have always geared towards that cult movie, that B movie, because to me, there's a lot of great movies out there that just bore me, so I can see, a film like last year's Moonlight, which I loved. I will never rewatch it again. It is a great film. It's an important film. I saw it.
You can understand why it's.
Yeah,
everyone liked it. Yeah.
But if I'm going to choose between that and Suspiria, I'm going to take Suspiria. And I do enjoy the pulpiness and the sleaziness. Those are things that I really kind of seek in film. And you can't get much sleazier or pulpy than Suspiria. I mean, but with your list, I do enjoy that, where I kind of got caught up in kind of what I watch all the time. Your films also, reminded me of a lot of stuff that I'm like, oh, holy shit, I need to revisit this stuff. These are things that are great, that are undeniable classics that I kind of get lost in my own taste in my own world, and I kind of forget about all the other movies.
Right. Well, and looking at my list, I realized that a lot of it is just what I had access to. What was it coming on HBO? Was it something that I could trick my grandmother into renting at the Farmore, where you put the VHS that you want to watch behind the picture of the VHS that you want your grandmother to believe you're watching, that kind of thing. And a lot of these really were movies that I had access to, movies that I had a lot of exposure to growing up. And there are very few recent movies on this list. And I think that it's probably a bias that you attach yourself to the movies that you watch when you're younger, and you attach yourself to the movies that kind of developed how you watch movies and your taste and everything like that. So with Jaws, one of the things, and I have watched Jaws so many times. I have tried to study Jaws from a lot of different perspectives, in a filmic way. Whenever I watch Jaws, it never stops being entertaining. It never stops drawing me in. Even if I am watching it from an abstract place, trying to figure out, oh, well, this is not really a three-act movie. It's a two-act movie. You have the first act that's a procedural almost with the classic, trying to figure out what's going on with these murders, how to stop them. Then you have the second act, which is it just completely flips and turns into Moby Dick. You have a three-hand play on a boat in the ocean. And it just, it's so satisfying to me. And it just, every single time I watch it, it just makes me, it just sucks me in. It is not one of those movies where I just appreciate it from a distance. It is a movie that just gets me right in the belly every single time. And it's really kind of interesting to watch, like, the boys as they get older and how they react to it, because it really is a visceral thing more than it is an intellectual thing. And I think that's probably why it's my number one.
No, I mean, that makes sense. And there's so much, and you can pull this away from a lot of, especially that era of Spielberg, where it's also really fun. I mean, as you get into that second act and they get on the boat, things get real serious, but there's always that levity, and you never get like too bogged down in the solemn and the darkness. It's you get those moments where you get to see people really just being normal people, and I think that's part of kind of the charm that sticks with it over time.
That's right, and so. It's always been one of those movies for me that whenever you watch it, you kind of always see like new things. There's always like little bitty things that, where you see you have a new appreciation for the mayor, and you have a new appreciation for all the different characters and everything. But one of my second movie that is on my list is actually the only movie that we have together on our list, which is Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, because it's perfect.
And it really is. And I wanted to fill out this list with probably maybe one or two more Star Wars, but in terms of being the exemplar of this entire universe, Empire Strikes Back is flawless. It really is.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's to me, that's a movie, there's very little, and once again, kind of playing into my taste, that movie throws a lot at you. That everything happens in Empire, and it's incredibly dark. It ends on a dour note, but that note that it ends on is really the thing that sets off the story of the other, I don't know how many movies there are now. But it packs everything to where if you're going to watch one Star Wars film and get an idea of what the whole story is overall, you've got it right there.
I agree. I think it's like it really created the emotional backbone that supported the rest of the Star Wars franchise. It created a feeling of depth, of real life, of darkness, of you know, twists and turns, of an entire universe that's ready to explore. You know, everything from the Minox to Cloud City to the Yoda training, everything about it is just so unique and so unexpected, especially after you watch the first Star Wars, where everything is kind of it's a classic hero tale. It is something that is, while it was, you know, obviously it made a big impact and it was unusual at the time, but in terms of the tale itself, the classic hero tale, it has a long pedigree. Empire completely throws all of that into the blender, and you don't really know what you're getting from one scene to the next. And it really is where everything is doom and gloom, but there's like these bright moments, and when I think of Star Wars, I think of Empire.
No, I'm in the same boat. Growing up, every time we were sick, our mom would, you know, immediately throw in those VHS tapes, and every single time, you know, no matter how sick I was, strep throat, flu, whatever, I'd usually, you know, kind of half sleep through New Hope and Return of the Jedi, but I would always stay awake all the way through Empire, because no matter how many times you see it, those reveals are great, and it also, to me, it does what I like most about Star Wars movies, which is take you a bunch of places. I mean, you get to go to, like right. You mentioned, you know, places like Cloud City and Hoth and all these like fantastic planets
and Dagobah.
Oh, and Dagobah, yes, and it moves these characters out of where in New Hope, Luke Skywalker he's like a whiny kid, and that second one kind of whips him into this maturity that is far more easy to root for as a hero than even and I think even better than Return of the Jedi. I can't, when all the other films I can poke holes, find things that I don't think are great. Empire, I think, is flawless pretty much from beginning to end.
I agree, and it's one of those things, one of those movies that is just absolutely rewatchable. There, you know, and it's really, if I'm not feeling well, if I'm sick, I'm at home, it's the movie that I turn to kind of like draw me in and chill me out. It's a perfect movie, top to bottom. It really is.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, so your second movie.
Yeah, my second movie, we're gonna go as far away on the spectrum as possible with 1997's Gummo, the experimental film from auteur and infant terrible Harmony Korine, basically being a series of vignettes that cover a small town in Ohio that gets ravaged by tornadoes. And to me, that's just one of those movies that really, when I finally saw it in the early 2000s, I was so just like disgusted and sucked in and just kept watching it over and over again, just trying to figure out what it was about that movie. And years later, I can still watch it, and I still don't know. It's incredibly ugly. It's nihilistic. It really doesn't have much redeeming qualities outside of the fact that it's just so damn well made, and it's absurdist, and there's just a lot that you continue to go back to the well and kind of discover little things here and there. But, and in the midst of that, you do have these like tender moments of humanity that shift. And as soon as you start getting comfortable with it, they automatically shift you into another just disgusting kind of, you know, worst white trash nightmare that you could ever have. Have you ever seen the film Gummo?
I have not. No, I have experienced white trash nightmares, but I have never, ever seen Gummo.
And that scene, what makes a lot of that stuff really disturbing, especially with the mentally handicapped girl and those scenes, is that most of the people in this film, outside of a few, are just real people, just acting out these. And she's someone that I could be wrong, and someone, you know, correct me and be snarky or whatever. But if I remember correctly, I believe the actress that does play that role is mentally handicapped. So it makes it just so much weirder. And I almost forget to mention that these are all kids in this movie. There's very few adults. It's kind of a world where children are kind of wildly ruling, most of these adults are either dead or completely out of the picture. So yeah, those scenes are so dark. And I mean, and like I say, it's not a movie that I walk around, like, you know, wearing a t-shirt and, you know, talking to Joe Schmo on the bus about, but I can't ever shake it. And I guess I'll just keep every, you know, 2 years going back to it and trying to continue to figure out what it is.
Well, and I imagine, I mean, knowing your list in advance, I imagine that's probably true for most of the movies on there, that these are movies that impacted you in a certain way, that that were not just unusual, but unique, that they stood out as you know, either just extraordinary expressions of personality and vision, or just things that are not usually put on screen and not usually delved into. And one of the things that I really need to, like, that your list has made me want to do is to, like, broaden my horizons and, like, start going into these different kinds of movies, because a lot of the things I do watch are mainstream, are the movies that come out with a marketing campaign that I hear about for weeks in advance, and then I don't watch them in the theater because I have children, and then I get them on demand.
Right.
Right. And so it does seem like with the movies that you've picked, they are more of a psychological or visceral type of reaction that you've had that's completely unique.
Right. And that's something that I always want. I always, when I'm going into a movie, I will forgive a lot if it's just something I've never seen before. I think that's, you know, one of those things, the same as I always say, the greatest crime is to be boring. One of the greatest things, if you want me to forgive a lot in your movie, do something that I've never seen before and cover something that's not usually, it being featured in film. And I think that that you'll see in my next couple of picks as well, where sometimes I just want an experience. I want something that is going to, you know, make me actually think about it. Because because I'm sure as we go down through episodes, we'll eventually talk about superhero films. But I love superhero films. I love these tentpole releases. But after I get out of them, all I remember is that I liked it and it was fun.
Right,
but rarely am I going to really remember too much else besides that. And I think Gummo's is falls into that category. But kind of shifting, what was your next film on your list?
Well, and speaking of, you know, things you don't see a lot of and that strike you as new is like Kurt Russell in a mullet and a white tank top battling superhuman ninjas and like saving the day. Like my third movie, and probably you can guess, is Big Trouble Little China. When I first saw it, I think I was maybe 10 years old, and I just couldn't believe it. I didn't even believe that this was actually a movie. It hit all of my soft spots, everything that I wanted to see in a movie. It had the fighting, it had the karate, it had the horror, it had the supernatural elements, it had the comedy, it everything about it, top to bottom, even now, just is perfect. It really, it makes me so happy. It's like a joyous experience to watch this film.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is another movie that I don't know why. After I saw it on your list, I instantly started thinking, man, how did this not end up somewhere? And if I would have done a top 20, it probably would have ended up on there. But yeah, no, I'm in the same boat because I was around the same age when I finally saw it. It kind of had like everything that I was into at that age. It was like a video game, comic book, you know, cartoon.
Monster.
Yeah, turned the light. Right. Yeah, I mean, because it's. I mean, like talking about before, it's a kitchen sink movie. They're putting everything in there. Kung fu, you know, monsters, horror, everything kind of into this giant blender.
Gunplay, machine guns, yeah. Like everything you could possibly want.
The coolest fucking hero who's not even really a hero. He's kind of a doofus who happens to accidentally win. But it's so much fun. And like, yeah, that was one of those movies that, a couple years ago, I was excited to show it to Matt because I was like, okay, you want to see something awesome? I pop it in, and yeah, I think that movie's going to outlast all of us, and kids forever are going to grow up watching, you know, Jack Burton kick ass.
Well, there's nothing that ages you more than to say they don't make movies like this, but they don't make movies like this anymore. This is a gem. It is such a B-movie genre movie, but it's also... It's a classic. It was when I watched this movie, just the beginning with Wang Chen and talking to the government bureaucrat, talking about, well, you leave Jack Burton alone. And then he has the lightning go through his hands and you just realize you're in for a ride. And then, of course, it just cuts to Jack Burton eating his sub sandwich, talking to himself on the radio. He never drives faster than he can see. Like that, it is just like top to bottom. It just is a propulsive movie. You get into that once that truck turns into the alley, and you have that fight between the good guys and the bad guys, and then the storm fighters come in and start just wrecking shit, and then he drives his truck through, and then from then on, it is just it is a like catch your breath. Complete propulsive movie. And I just every time I can catch it on cable, I can just see the cover of it and I'm hooked. I'm in. I want to watch it right now.
Oh yeah, and let's not forget the sexy mannequin herself, Kim Cattrall.
Oh yeah, and she was the sexy mannequin before she was this girl. And the sexy mannequin really, I think it probably started my puberty like a couple of years earlier than it should have. The mannequin, and I forgot what the name of the guy, the actor was, that he was in Weekend at Bernie's. That was a movie that was, just Kim Cattrall was at the top of my list.
Right.
And then I saw this movie and she was probably a number one, throughout my entire adolescence.
Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And that's one of those actresses that you kind of forget how great she was during that era, you know, between, you know, Police Academy, and, you know, I believe she was in Porky's as well, if I'm remembering correctly. And, you know, all the way through, I mean, just shit, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
she's fucking great and gorgeous in that movie too. And, I think that whole, like, with Sex and the City, I think people forget that she, once upon a time, she was, you know, I mean, of course, she was foxy on that, but not foxy like she was in the 80s.
And she had that kind of breathless feminism that was, you know, vulnerable, needed to be protected. It was everything that you could possibly want as a young boy that was starting to, like, really learn what those things were.
Yeah. You mean a blossoming pervert?
Yeah. Well, that's the same thing, right? I mean, that's what a young boy is.
Right. Absolutely. And
so your number three is Enter the Void.
Yeah, Enter the Void, the Gaspar Noé film. It's had a few different releases over the past few years. I believe it was English French co-production, and it's by far the biggest chore that's on my list. It's a long film, I believe, clocking in at almost 3 hours, maybe 3 hours plus on the extended, but is an interesting film that kind of goes over the idea of like what happens with the spirit when you die, and basically follows a young American expat in Tokyo who's experimenting with a lot of drugs and ends up dying while being on DMT. And throughout the rest of the movie is really just his spirit kind of going in and out of everyone that's in his life. And everything is from that first person perspective. And it's very experimental. It seems to kind of like to sniff its own farts for some of it, but I have to forgive it, and I have to put it in the top of my list because there's nothing else out there like it. Gaspar Noé is a director that I generally enjoy quite a bit with films like I Stand Alone, Irreversible, and this movie is no exception. So I wanted to kind of pick between his films, and this was the one that I thought is the most impressive, and just this entire like landscape of this like neon Tokyo is just absolutely amazing. I got the opportunity to see it in theaters, and just blew my mind. As soon as it came out on Blu-ray, I was quick to buy it, rewatch it, and just couldn't get over how amazing of a feat it is. There's a lot of shock in the movie, a lot of unsimulated sex, things like that, that kind of get in the distraction of that movie, and a lot of people end up talking about that more than what he's actually doing, because I don't think there's more interesting.
Well, I mean, unsimulated sex tends to get a lot of conversation.
It does, yeah. I mean, you can only put so many unsimulated blowjobs in a movie before people stop paying attention to cinematography. but like his last film, Love, that was released and bizarrely is on Netflix. It's another one of those cases where he gets all the publicity for the more extreme choices made, but when you're watching those movies, you can't help but think that he deserves to be in the same conversation as a lot of the French greats like Godard, Truffaut, and you know, the long line of that. But yeah, this is a movie that really kind of just always kind of captures me. And when people ask me about, you know, what films have kind of changed my perspective on what movies should be, this is always in there. And it's the one and only time that Paz de la Huerta has been remotely watchable. I hate to knock her, but a lot of people, if you've kept up with her performances over the past few years, you'll be shocked at how good she is. And I just can't get away from it. And hope that, you know, that you get an opportunity, because I think I am going to be dropping off with the kid tomorrow, dropping off a stack of DVDs for you, and this is going to be in there.
Yeah, well, I definitely have some homework assignments. Since I've only seen two movies on your top 10, it was shocking to me because I realized how much more of a cinematic universe is out there than I've been exposed to. Now, you know, the unsimulated sex is going to obviously curtail the times that I can watch it. It's going to be not only after the boys go to bed, but when Robin is not around, because she frowns upon those kinds of things.
So you're going to watch it without nothing?
Well, I am going to watch it. Yes, all of these movies I am going to watch. And, you know, my taste and my approach to that kind of stuff is that and maybe it's just my Baptist upbringing, which I've now rejected, but it removes me. It, like, the suspension of disbelief that's required to watch a movie, it gets shattered when I see, like raunchy sex scenes. It's just one of those things that's always happened, that the raunchy sex scenes become the one thing, that you actually remember and experience, and that the rest of the movie just kind of passes you by. For instance, Basic Instinct. It's very difficult for me to appreciate Basic Instinct as, like, it actually is a really well-made movie, but the sex scenes in that movie are so dramatic and blatant that it's really difficult for me to, like, kind of move past that. Also, Basic Instinct was one of those movies I put behind the VHS that I got my grandma to rent for me at Farmore when I was about 11. And so maybe that's another reason why it's very difficult to move past the sex scenes, because it was the first thing that exposed me to that kind of thing.
Right, but you'll see, once you see the film, you'll see it's very different than like what you're getting in like a Paul Verhoeven movie, where it's, you know, it's intentionally sleazy and pulpy. The way sex is handled with Enter the Void, it's incredibly graphic. And I don't want to ruin anything for you, because it's almost laughable, but it does play into this this story, because I don't think I mentioned this, but the story is following the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And in order to get to a certain step in that cycle in the film, you have to get this thing, and it is, oh man, is it glorious when it happens. I turn into a 12-year-old and laugh every single time. But yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but I keep an open mind on this one, because there's so much to and so much to take in with the film, that it's the smallest part of a much grander thing.
And one of the grander things that I'd like to talk about, my number five movie, is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is, to me, one of the most transporting experiences that I've ever had watching a movie. Now, it probably has something to do with that I was in college and maybe doing a little bit of drugs. And I was in the right mindset to appreciate this full throttle, drug-induced fantasy and how sideways everything feels, and how uncomfortable and nervous it makes me feel, even while I'm laughing my ass off. It is one of the hallmarks of movies, just in terms of creating a feeling. Creating a whole reality that actually feels like what it would be like to do that, and to be in that time and place and under those drugs and influences and everything. From the get-go, with the driving down the interstate with Johnny Depp's character, just taking all the different drugs out of the suitcase. Starting to trip and watching the bats, and then moving on into Las Vegas. Like in my experience, it is one of those things that is not. I've never had another movie do that to me like this movie.
No, and that's a movie that I need to revisit, because I loved it when I was younger, and I think it was the backlash of being in college, and every time, you know, you smoked weed with your buddies, they would throw it in, that I think I just kind of take it for granted now.
Oh yeah, I was probably that guy.
Right, but it's one of those movies that I need to revisit, because I'm admittedly not a big Terry Gilliam fan, but I remember liking it a lot. I don't remember a whole lot. I remember Benicio del Toro just being just fucking awesome in that role. But yeah, that's just one I need to revisit, because it's been a while. It's been at least, I don't know, 10 or 15 years since I've seen it.
Yeah, my favorite Benicio del Toro role, and he's had so many good ones, but this is my favorite. He's a chunky, drugged out lawyer who everything that happens is met with violence or legal threats, and it is absolutely fantastic. Now I'm a lawyer, so that hits really close to home, but it was. There is something like it's a buddy comedy, but they kind of separate and they just orbit each other. I really think it's Johnny Depp's best role too. He totally inhabits the character there's no note that's wrong. Everything that he does is completely believable and completely, it makes sense within the terms of the character, the Hunter S. Thompson that he's playing. And then, you know, I used to watch this movie going to bed. Like I would put it on, and this would be like my kind of invitation into dreams. And it just, even now when I watch it, it's It's like a callback to another time in my life. It just transports me every single time.
Oh yeah, no, I definitely understand that kind of experience. Like like one of those movies that you attach more to a time in your life than the film itself. I mean, even though it is a great film, but you can kind of remember kind of all that entire kind of era of your life. No, but I definitely understand that side of it.
And it does have it's a little bit like Boogie Nights, where you have the first half, which is just balls to the wall fun, and then the second half, which is dark and kind of upsetting, and definitely not it doesn't reward the audience in any particular way. It just gets like somber,
right.
But it really is like a. The first half especially, and by then I'm usually asleep, but the first half especially is just one of the best things that I've ever experienced.
Oh, yeah. I remember that first half being a lot of fun. And speaking of fun, my next film on my list is a very fun, very, very dumb movie. And for most people, their number four of all time is probably – or number five, excuse me, of all time is probably not going to be this, but – mine is Maniac Cop 2, made by the fantastic William Lustig, the director behind Maniac oh, Cop, yeah. As well as, you know, Vigilante and a lot of other, a lot of other of those kind of, late 70s, early 80s era New York films written by Larry Cohen of, Cue the Winged Serpent and also The Stuff. And it's what I love about that movie is the first film is a great kind of, slasher kind of film with Bruce Campbell. It kind of takes itself pretty serious. The second one, it is like a Hong Kong action film combined with like the grossest serial killer movie.
This is the second movie, the only other movie besides Empire on your list that I've actually seen. And I saw it when I was about 12, and it blew me away. It was just, I can't believe I'm actually watching this.
Yeah.
Like it was amazing.
It really is. I mean, it's one of those movies where, I mean, there's these awesome car chases. You have scenes where people are being dragged and fighting off of cars. You've got these really like. Just disturbing out of a different whole fucking movie kind of murder scenes and rape scenes that when it all culminates, it's just like once you end up in the final showdown in the prison with with the titular maniac cop, it gets so insane. And that burn scene where he sets fire has got to be one of the longest burns in history. Because he is on fire for the last 10 minutes of that movie.
Oh, yeah, he's
fighting
on fire.
His way through a prison.
For a long time.
And then from that, it transfers into one of the worst rap summaries of a film. Where it turns into a title, the title card that kicks off a rapping maniac cop song.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's another one of those movies. To me, it's like a lazy Sunday. If you ask me what I'm watching, I'm sitting at home. Eating lunch, watching Maniac Cop 2. And part of what I love about it is that with both the film Maniac Cop and also Maniac, the film Maniac, is it's kind of a sequel to both films where that serial killer from Maniac, unfortunately with Joe Spinell's untimely death, they didn't get a chance to do another entry there. It feels like a spiritual sequel to that film as well. And yeah, no, I just one of those movies that I can't leave off the list. It's not going to end up on any kind of AFI list, but I do think that's one of those movies that will continue to go in and out of the cult movie conversation, because I think each generation is going to end up finding this movie. Because in all fairness, Maniac Cop is kind of a B movie to a B movie. It's very much it's derivative. The first one is good, but it's just kind of taking from a lot of things from that era. But once you get into that sequel, it is undeniably fun. And
oh yeah,
I know. I'm glad that you've seen that one.
Yeah, I ended up watching it with my dad at 11. We were down in Gulf Shores on a vacation, and it was just on HBO or, you know, one of those movie channels, and we put it on, and my dad fell asleep, so he wasn't there to turn it off, and I just sat there with my mouth open the entire time.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe this is actually happening, and I'm actually watching this.
Oh, yeah, and even at age 35, I still watch that movie with my mouth wide open because I just I can't believe that there was an era where people were willing to take that kind of chance and put that kind of money up for a movie that, I mean, let's face it, I mean, it wasn't going to be treated with any kind of seriousness.
Yeah, it wasn't going to be a Citizen Kane or anything, that's for sure. It was right in its lane, but it exceeded all expectations.
Yeah, but I mean, on top of it all, William Lustig treated it like it was Citizen Kane. It could have been tongue in cheek, but he kept it. He pursued the film he wanted to make. He took it serious, and when you take that kind of B-level movie, treat it with a little bit of sincerity, you'll get a great result, because those are the stories that people enjoy the most. Usually when
yeah,
you talk
that's
to
right.
people, yeah, the stories that they like, the stuff that you see that continues to live on in pop culture, it's not always the most, you know, artistic things, but yeah, that's a movie that is always going to be on my short list, and if it may be that one movie if I was stuck on a desert island that I just like to watch all the time.
Yeah, and you know, the talking about how you can really feel it when the directors, you know, the people that are making movies, they just are all in. They have all their cards on the table. And that's like my next movie, Zodiac. I feel that, you know, I love Fincher. I probably could have put 3 or 4 of his other movies on here. This is the only one that's on my top 10 list, the only Fincher movie that's on my top 10 list. But it is... It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece and obsession. And the not only the just the, you know, how wonderfully it's just thoughtful it is, and how much attention to detail it takes to bring you back into that time period in San Francisco with the Zodiac killer running around, but just the way that it delves into the idea of obsession itself, the idea of obsessive procedure, the idea of this great unknown that has no answer, that you can't get out of your mind, that ruins your family, ruins your friendships, ruins everything, but you can't stop thinking about it, can't stop focusing about it. And Zodiac is, it is probably, if I had to say that, if I had any of these movies in my top 10 that I would hold up as a cinematic masterpiece, it would probably be Zodiac. In my mind, is absolutely flawless.
Oh, yeah, and that's one of those weird movies where when I initially saw it in theaters, I wasn't huge on it. Like, I was expecting something really different, and in all fairness, I didn't really know much about the Zodiac Killer. I just knew it was a David Fincher movie, and from at that point, it was a big departure from what he was doing with, you know, Fight Club, Alien 3, Panic Room, those kind of movies. And
right.
I remember I kind of walked out like, that was all right. And probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years later, I watched it again. And I really was floored, but I was like, man, what the hell was wrong with me that day? I must have been in a bad mood or something, because it really is a really good movie. Like you said, about obsession, and kind of goes after the serial killer from a completely different angle of, you know, not focusing on the cops or anything like that, but just focusing in on one guy who knows that he's as smart or smarter than the killer, and follows, you know, throughout pretty much his entire life in that movie. So yeah, no, I definitely agree that's a movie that could easily end up on a list and probably one of Fincher's best films.
And, you know, and I think that the way that it treats the serial killer is like this, not just obviously physical, like, terror, but like a spiritual terror, like this unknowability about it, this mystery, this absolute like darkness at the edge of the screen, and the everything is you because you don't know where it's coming from or who it is. Everything has this pall of tension and this nervousness that as you walk, you could be in the newsroom watching a cart full of packages being like, you know, thrown out by the mailman, and it just feels ominous, and it feels just absolutely full of foreboding. And there's as far as atmospherics and the way that the characters interact, there's nothing like it. Zodiac, I think it's the peak Gyllenhaal. I think it's probably peak Iron Man. I forgot what his name is.
Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, I think it's peak Robert Downey Jr. There's not a note that's struck in that movie that feels off. And it's so rewatchable. And you really do kind of get sucked into like the whodunit. Is it this guy? The way that Fincher makes the movie, he gives you a reason to believe that every single person they're investigating is the actual killer. So when they end up in that guy's basement, when Gyllenhaal ends up in that guy's basement, you really feel like, oh, he finally found the killer and this is him. And any other movie would have cashed in on that. But the fact that it just keeps going with not knowing, with uncertainty, with dead ends and disappointment. And it just felt to me like it's unlike any other movie because it doesn't cash in those chips. But when you get to the end, it's still unknown. It's still unknowable. And that's what you're left with.
Oh, no, absolutely. And with that kind of unknowability, that transitions well into my next film, which is Possession, and not the Possession with Sarah Michelle Gellar. This is the 1981.
I know
film.
You're a big Sarah fan.
I love her as Daphne, but unfortunately, it is not that film. It's the 1981 film from Andrzej Zawalski. I am totally butchering his name. The great Polish director who passed last year. And this is the story of Sam Neill, who plays a spy who returns back home to his wife and his child, and things have become amiss. His wife is clearly breaking down in front of him, eventually asking for a divorce, disappearing, losing time, as well as kind of tossing their son Bob into the middle. And on top of all this, this is also a ooey-gooey monster flick. And as strange as this movie is, and you've probably seen, you know, plenty of gifts, you know, given from the Frankie Johnny performance, it is a movie built around insanity. Every single scene, the actors, you know, especially Sam Neill and Frankie Johnny, just turn everything up to 11, and they just, it's so primitive, and the film really, it captures like the kind of like hatred and insanity that kind of follows, you know, what being in a relationship can be like. And it's one of those movies. Once again, it's not a fun one. We'll get to, you know, we like Maniac Cop 2, but it is such an impression on me because when I originally saw this film, they originally did a U.S. release that had about 25 minutes cut out, and I had rented it from Hollywood Video, and I was watching it, and I saw it, and I was like, that's fine, whatever, and just kind of moved on. It was interesting. And then I heard another podcast that was talking about it probably about 8 years ago, and they were talking about all these scenes. I was thinking, man, I don't remember any of that. And went out and got a full international cut release, and I was just floored. It was so strange. It was unsettling. The way that they handled these scenes of this child that's stuck in the middle, and just this idea of, When you are in a relationship, would you be happy to just be able to mold your own version of someone? And I always think that's like incredibly simple, but the way it handles it is incredibly profound. And when you finally get to the end of that movie, it's so bleak that it's one of the few movies that I think really actually disturbs me, where a lot of film, especially kind of with shock cinema, which this is not, it'll bug me maybe, or it may disturb me to a degree, but I always know it's a movie. For some reason, this film, it gets me deeper in my core. And I think that's an important thing when you're dealing with, you know, about taking a B film, giving a shit about it, and creating a completely unique experience and piece of art. And with the other films I've seen from Zlowski, seems to be his MO, especially with the great film that was released last year, right around the time of his passing, Cosmos, which I urge everyone to get off VOD and settle in for a fucked up night. But is this one that you've had any kind of experience with?
No, and actually, I had not even known this movie existed until you put it on your list, and most of those movies that are on your list, actually had that kind of impact on me. I obviously know Sam Neill. Everyone right. Our age knows Sam Neill. Obviously from Jurassic Park, one of my favorite horror movies, which is Event Horizon. I was working in the movie theaters when that thing came out, and I watched it probably 11, 12, 13, I mean, countless times. So I've always been a big fan of Sam Neill, and I just had not ever heard of this movie.
Yeah, I got to ask you, are you a fan of In the Mouth of Madness?
Yes. I had a whole John Carpenter phase where I just, I went deep. It was, Carpenter and Cronenberg, I went deep in all of their movies. It was right around the time I was in college. I was taking film classes. And In the Mouth of Madness, probably has the most an indelible scene where he's driving down the road and that demon drives by on the bicycle in that dark road and just goes by the car and looks at him and then continues on. I have nightmares about that still, just that one vision. When you said that, Sam Neill was in this, I was really, it really sparked my interest.
Yeah. And the reason I bring up In the Mouth of Madness is if you remember how big he plays that role, especially in the beginning and the end, he plays it bigger in Possession, even bigger than that, even bigger than the sorry about the balls, scene of, In the Mouth of Madness. So, right. That's another one of the movies that I think eventually, as we keep discussing, different themes and films, it's going to come up again. So I will be curious to see what you think of that. But let's move on with your next pick as we kind of move in, and as we kind of move into this second, the second half of the list, we are going to move a little bit more briskly. We really wanted to make sure to cover, in the top five, how much, we were, thing, but, as we move into the second five, we're going to go through it a little bit faster, just so we don't lose you good folks at home.
That's right. So my next film is Pulp Fiction, and it's no surprise. I think that's probably on a lot of people's top 10. It came out in 1994. I was 13 years old. I was somehow lucky enough to see it in the movie theater, and it just was unlike anything I'd ever seen. It was... The dialogue is so eminently quotable. There's not just with the words they say, but the things they do. A lot of the antics are visual. Everyone remembers probably when he shoots the poor guy in the head and then back of the car and that kind of thing, and that's really funny. But just the little moments where they're standing in the elevator and Vincent says, oh, he wants me to take care of her, and then Samuel Jackson's character puts the gun to his head. He's like, take care of her. It's everything about it is just note perfect, every single scene is a masterclass in setup and dialogue and execution. And it really is. It's unlike anything else that I've seen.
Yeah, and that's one of those movies that I always think of as being one of the kind of defining films of kind of our generation. Those people, you know, all of us born between 75 and 85, that you can't have a discussion about movies without Pulp Fiction coming into play, because I think it is that important in kind of the way all of us kind of grew up watching movies. And it's probably Tarantino's a big reason that when I was in those teenage years, I started, you know, checking out these films that he was name dropping and these influences, and got me to go, you know, start digging into, you know, a grindhouse, you know, more grindhouse kind of films, blaxploitation, Sam Peckinpah films, samurai flicks.
And right.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I would say that my obsession with that kind of cinema really came from Pulp Fiction.
And yeah. I agree. You know, the Tarantino makes films with every scene has a hyperlink, and you can go as deep as you want to, and follow it through to all of his all of the people that you know, that he's either quoting or that he's referencing. And it really is. It in terms of getting into movies and like really getting into the history of movies, there's nothing like Tarantino, and there's nothing like Pulp Fiction.
Oh, absolutely. And with a movie that's incredibly unique, my next pick is the Japanese 1977 film Haozu, a.k.a. House. And this is not the William Cat House, but a bizarre fever dream horror film that was released by Toho and had a nice size budget behind it, you know, coming out of the kind of the premier Japanese studio system. And it's an incredibly strange story about a group of Japanese schoolgirls going to visit one of the girls' aunts, and it turns into a weird story of witchcraft as well as sexuality and just mishmash of bizarre nightmare imagery. And a lot of it's incredibly childish and playful, and I've always thought it was interesting because the director, once again I'm going to butcher his name, Nobuhiko Abayashi, he when he was trying to come up with these nightmare scenarios, he was talking to his young daughter and getting the things, and he letting her describe the scenes in and you know, or in her nightmares, and kind of brings them to play to where it's, you know, a lot of this, you know, floating disembodied heads, you know, biting girls on the ass, and you know, people, yeah, and absurdism, like people being eaten by pianos, and a strange time where a man just turns into a pile of bananas, and it's one of those movies where its cult status has really kind of picked up, you know, probably over the last about 10 to 12 years. And I got an opportunity to show my entire family, in fact, and as much as as it started, they all kind of thought it was kind of silly and dumb. By the end, you couldn't help, because he nails weird, which I think that's something that most people can't do. You can, trying to be weird and absurdist and strange, if you try too hard, everybody's gonna smell it on you. Yeah, and it's gonna fall apart. It's gonna remind you of like U-Turn by Oliver Stone, where it's just like, yeah, we see what you're trying to do, but you didn't have to try so hard.
Yeah, you can't try to be weird. You just have to be weird.
Exactly. So that's a movie that just nails weird, and but does it with such precision and class that if you feel like you're almost part of a club once you've seen it, because you are going to talk about it. You are going to make your friends sit and watch it. And it currently has a fantastic release from Criterion that's got a lot of, you know, really great special features with, you know, a lot of working directors now kind of talking about, well, you know, how much it influenced them. But
And then my next movie, started me thinking about cinematography and how much of an effect it has on a feel, on the way that a movie can immerse you into a story And it's Children of Men by Alfonso Cuarón, which I think is an absolute masterpiece. It's a, you know, I think that it, the cinematography, the set pieces, the long, unbroken tracking shots, all these things, you know, there's been lots of stuff written about them, but it really is, when you watch it, it just sucks you in because of the way that it's filmed and the way that the story is told. It's told from, and the camera rarely moves from, Clive Owen's character, Theo. The camera basically hovers over his shoulder throughout the entire movie. And you're experiencing things from his perspective. You're seeing things from his perspective. You're reacting to things like he's reacting to. It is one of those movies where, and obviously, it didn't have a hero in the classical sense. This is a hero that's kind of passive, that things are happening to him, and that the world itself is happening to him. And so because that's your perspective as the audience, you're going along for the ride. It's happening to you, too. I mean, from the very first scene with the explosion in the coffee shop. How he goes in, he sees a baby Diego died, and then he gets a coffee, he walks out, the camera stays on him, it turns around, and then you see the big explosion. There are two other enormous cinematographic scenes like that where the camera just stays on him and it's one long unbroken cut, and that itself creates the feeling of complete immersion. And then of course it's so lived in. You know, you have all of the wonderful characters, Michael Caine's character, Jasper. You have Julianne Moore's character, Julian, even Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's, you know, my favorite movie is Serenity. But this is the first kind of exposure I had to him. It's just great. Like, the whole thing is... it's one of those movies that if I have company over and they haven't seen it, I make them watch it.
Oh, yeah. And that's a movie that I saw, you know, initially and haven't had a chance to revisit it since. But what stuck with me were those long takes. I mean, you can't deny that that's, you know, a cinematic wonder in itself. And I mean, and even with Cuarón's other films like Birdman, which I'm not real high on, but also The Revenant.
I think Birdman is Iñárritu, right?
Shit, yeah.
Cut that. Yeah, it's okay. They're all Spanish.
Yeah. but also
like Gravity.
Yeah, right, which is a movie
is another cinematographic wonder, and you know, they all have they all have this kind of feel of. Where it's like magic. You don't understand how the camera's doing what it's doing. You don't understand, like, and so it actually makes you feel like you're there, like you're actually in the mix, because you don't feel that. It's not like the camera like steps out and makes you notice it. It's just that the what you're looking at doesn't feel possible from a cinematic standpoint, and so it just becomes it becomes real. So that's my next one for sure.
Yeah, and my next is Santa Sangre from Alejandro Jodorowsky, who is one of my definitely in my top three directors of all time. You know, making films like El Topo, The Holy Mountain, and most recently Endless Poetry. Just the king of surrealism, absurdism. But this is probably his most straightforward film. That basically follows a former circus artist who escapes from a mental hospital to rejoin his armless mother, who's in charge of this strange religious cult. And he's kind of forced by her to enact revenge on her behalf. And it's strange, like you have with El Topo and Holy Mountain, but it does follow a certain cohesive storyline, and it blends this like grotesque horror with also this fantastic kind of Fellini-esque art film where you see him have to become his mother's arms after her arms are cut off by the government. And you see, and you watch, you know, the lead played by Jodorowsky's son, Axel Jodorowsky, you know, have to be, you know, move with the his mother in the film, and literally be her arms. And it's another one that I never stop thinking about, because there's so much there that every time you watch it, there's a huge amount of things that I miss. And maybe I'm dumb, but every time I walk away with noticing 5 or 6 other things that I just love about it. And it's definitely his most accessible. So if you are trying to kind of get through the Jodorowsky movies, I think this is a great kind of starting point. It feels a little bit more familiar than the other films, just because it is essentially a horror film, and you can kind of keep up with those tropes, but it kind of slowly introduces you to his strangeness. And when we talked earlier about in how Zoo being effortlessly weird, Jodorowsky is the definition of it. When you see, you know, films by, you know, David Lynch, you know, and people of that elk, it's coming from Jodorowsky. He's taking that aesthetic and creating something that is watchable, cohesive, while still being odd at every turn.
And that brings me to my next movie, Apocalypse Now, by Francis Ford Coppola. And if there was one word that I had to use, it would be hypnotic. That it is, when you put that movie on, you sit back, turn off the lights, turn up the volume. It is a hypnosis experience. You get so drawn in to the rhythms of this movie, to the character rhythms, the way people talk, the scenes of grotesquity that are obviously just getting worse and worse as they go down this river. And it also happens to be, you know, one of my favorite books is Heart of Darkness. And so I probably was, I was just mentally and emotionally prepared to enjoy a movie like this. But when I first saw this movie, it felt like an experience, or like a spiritual experience in a way, or like an education. I don't even know. It was something that I had never felt watching a movie. I was completely drawn in. I started like just thinking about certain scenes and like callbacks to the certain lines and certain pieces of dialogue, and the Redux edition, like how it just draws out that world and creates even more curlicue detours in terms of you know, the French family and the Playboy bunnies, and it's frightening. It exposes you to this side of human nature that feels real, that feels foreign at the same time, and it just feels absolutely frightening.
Oh yeah, there's no denying that. That is an absolute American classic. Unlike my next film, which is Ghoulies 2.
It's, well, hey, that Ghoulies 2 is great.
Ghoulies 2 is fantastic. It is the first Ghoulies film from the always, okay, let's not say always, the occasionally great Full Moon Pictures. It's a sequel to the original, which is a pretty middling movie. It's okay. It's a little boring. It's got some fun stuff in it, but they show up in Ghoulies 2 and kind of deliver on what you wanted the first time. You know, of course, the ghoulies are back. They're summoned by a magician, but this time they are at an amusement park and spending all their time in the local haunted house there, getting an opportunity to, you know, terrorize and kill all the annoying teenagers that you can stomach, and eventually culminate into a pretty great finale where you get to just see all the havoc that you wish you saw in the last film. And for me, it's one of those movies that it's corny, it's silly, but it really falls into like a quintessential monster film. it's designed for that kind of drive-in experience. You can't help you laugh the whole time. It's got a bunch of strange stuff that's just there for padding, but you forgive it because it's so much fun when they finally do get on screen, and they don't waste any of that screen time with the monsters. And when you finally get to that that finale, it's completely batshit. It's a great time, and it's kind of one of those movies to drink a couple beers and just have a good time with.
Yeah, and speaking of good time, my next movie, Ghostbusters, is one of the all-time good times. It's peak everybody. It's peak Harold Ramis. It's peak Ivan Reitman. It's peak, obviously all the actors and everything. But my favorite, of course, is Bill Murray. It's peak Bill Murray. It is the number one Bill Murray movie of all time. His character, Peter Venkman, is so watchable and charismatic, but at the same time despicable and just socially unacceptable. And he's larger than life. He anchors the movie, and which is obviously something that was necessary given the subject matter, which is, you know, these ghosts are taking over the world, and these four dudes that happen to have a pretty good science background are going to be able to stop. And I know this is probably something that has been written about a lot, the improv nature of the script, how you can just tell these are guys that are experts at getting into a situation and just letting it breathe and letting it, be real for them, and improvising all of these different scenes. And it makes it feel fresh. It makes it feel realistic, even when all of this completely batshit crazy stuff is happening. It's right up there in the list of rewatchables. I could watch it for just any time, every day. If I catch it on cable, I'm sucked in. It is one of the best.
Oh, absolutely. And my final film on the list is the 29th installment of what we'll call Legacy instead of a series. It is Godzilla Final Wars. It is the biggest, probably most exciting of all the kaiju films. It eventually kind of turns out to be, it basically plays out almost like a greatest hits of Godzilla, where you get all the best of the other films. They bring in every monster you can imagine. You've got Gigan, Mothra, Baby Godzilla. Everybody ends up making an appearance, and blends with a ridiculous, over-the-top sci-fi story that's also mixed with kind of like Matrix-era kung fu. And it just is absolutely batshit. Complete, kitchen sink movie. But it's a great introduction, especially to younger audiences, and is always a film that's in rotation at my home. And if I talk to someone, they're like, and they haven't really seen Japanese, especially 90s era Godzilla films, I'll usually start with that one, and of course explain, like, this isn't like the rest, but this is going to give you a huge look at where the Godzilla story ended up in the 90s, and it covers everything like that. I mean, with Godzilla, it's something that's been a huge part of my life since I was a kid. It's one of those
Godzilla movies. 1984 was I would dream in the language of that movie.
Right, and it was one of those things where when I was a kid on Channel 11, on Saturday morning, I would get up in time to watch monster movies and kung fu flicks. So in my mind, Godzilla is just, it's been a part of my memory. And like you said, like, you know, my cinematic language since I started watching movies. So to me, this is the movie that kind of helps you recapture that feeling of being a kid, even when you are a jaded 35-year-old with more hair on his back than his head. and it really...
Yeah.
I
haven't seen that one, but the Godzilla just universal, or the expanded universe of Godzilla, like, that is something that has been a part of my life since I can even remember. There's something special and something magnetic about Godzilla, and a giant monster that is really can't give a shit about human beings, that is just wrecking everything, that is, you know, fighting things that are like his size and not really giving a crap about anyone else. No. And like how scary it is to be the anyone else.
Right, because yeah, because everything is bigger than you, and I think that's what helps make out of all the kaiju films, what makes Godzilla so special is everything is bigger than you. There's nothing. Even when they have storylines, that storyline is epic in proportion. It's always like it's the world. It's not even when it's just Tokyo. It's far bigger than that, and that kind of makes, you know, me want to just give a big shout out to Shin Godzilla that finally got a full U.S. release this week, and I think that is a great follow up to kind of reboot the series. And Chris, check Vudu. I got it on.
Oh yeah, I just saw that you bought it recently, right? This is something that just showed up.
Yeah, yeah. And for everyone, so it's not too inside baseball here. We do share a Vudu account to put on top of our. Our already strange relationship. We also share a Vudu account. So, Shin Godzilla, man, it's on there.
And then, so my last one, and the reason why you're not, I guess, doing the last one, because we already went over Empire. That was on your list.
Correct.
My last one is Hunt for Red October, a Sam Neill movie. it's the top of the Jack Ryan movies. I really like Patriot Games, too, but... Hunt for Red October is, it really takes me back. It makes me, it just makes me believe that this, like, this whole Cold War thing is actually going on in the on screen. And you know, I think a lot of people get upset about Sean Connery's Russian accent or whatever. Nothing like that ever bothered me. It is just a gorgeous film. It is really, The way that it unfolds and how tense it is and how interesting it is from a geopolitical perspective, it really is something else. They don't make movies like that anymore, Blaine. They really don't. It's not a lot of flashbang. It's just a lot of intrigue, and it's just one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's a movie that I need to revisit. I haven't seen it in 20 years, and I just remember being a kid and having no interest, but I'm sure that's something that would appeal to me more. But no, that was fantastic. I mean, I am glad that we got an opportunity to kind of lay out, let everybody know what we're going to be talking about, give them a general peek into kind of what we love about cinema, and give everyone kind of a little perspective on where we're going to be coming from in these upcoming episodes. And with our next episode, we are going to be revisiting Chris's number one film, Jaws, and talking about that a little bit more in depth, as well as doing top five lists. That's going to be under the theme of Jaws with Paws, where we're going to each, you know, kind of discuss, you know, films of nature run amok, and ones that the good, the bad, and the ones we just can't help but include. So Chris, so everyone can follow you, where are you at on social media?
Oh, I'm entirely absent. So you can't follow me, but you can listen to this podcast. And this was a lot of fun, Blaine. I really am excited to get started on all this stuff, to talk about all of our favorite movies, movies that we just watched, movies that we've seen a million times. And this was a lot of fun. I really had a good time.
No, same here. I think this is going to be a really fun experience going through and, you know, exploring movies as well as, you know, continuing our friendship and our co-parenting experience. And if you want to follow me, I am on both Twitter and Instagram at Mondo_McLaren. You can also download my other show, Grindhouse Messiah, where me and Justin Harlan talk about faith and fringe cinema. We've recently released two episodes, one that's covering Fantasia Fest, which you can also visit my reviews, which I did about four or five this year for that film festival, as well as our interview with the incomparable Stephen Biro of Unearthed Films, where we get to talk about God, The Devil, and also the newest American Guinea Pig film. hey, Robin, you want to take us out and say goodbye to everybody?
Bye, everyone.
All right. There you go. Well, we'll see you soon here in the next couple of weeks, and we'll talk to you then. Peace.